You know, like Mark Twain, I'm very embarrassed when people compliment me. I think they're not saying enough. Before I tell you my name, I read someplace that it says the intelligence of a group is measured by how well they pronounce a foreign name. My name is Ajit. I'm sitting at the Mensa crowd in here, that's great. I feel like a mosquito in a nudist colony. I don't know where to begin. So I guess I'll start with the preliminaries. I want to thank Charlie for inviting me to this conference and then picking me up at the airport and being a wonderful host. And for the committee for sanctioning that, thank you. Dottie and Marilyn and the rest. I found out that Marilyn has an affinity for young boys. She calls herself Mrs. Robinson. I've noticed most of the Alateen guys have been staying away from her. No, it's been a wonderful weekend. The speakers have been phenomenal, starting with Louisa. God, she was exuding that serenity she was describing as tranquility. I felt very tranquil watching that wonderful smile of hers. I envy you. You're her husband. That's wonderful. And in the morning, Susie, wow, and followed by Lyle, and then, of course, last night, Marge. It shows the indomitable spirit that this program gives us. You know, she's like the phoenix last night. I couldn't believe the stuff I was hearing from Marge. I said, God almighty, I would have called an exorcist by that time, or called a feng shui expert. Something moved out of that town. God, my heart goes out to you. That's great. So it's good to be here. Thank you. I do want to welcome all my Al-Anon friends. Hello. If there's any members of AA in here, I welcome you too. And those dubious double winners or dual members. How do you do it if you're an alcoholic, also member of Al-Anon? Do you obsess over yourself and try and stay away from booze? Must be fun. I tell you, I can tell you, my name is of Indian extraction, not the feathered kind, but the turban kind, although I've worn neither. So I'll dispel all stereotypes when it comes to Indians. I do not wear my spikes on the inside of my golf shoes. I don't sleep on a bed of nails. I don't wear turbans. I don't wear loincloths. And I don't toss my head around every time I say something. And I say, yes, I do this, not too. I'll tell you in a second what my problem is. You'll recognize that I can't remember exactly when I walked into Al-Anon. It was circa 1980, but I can tell you to the moment when she walked into AA, May 25th, 1983, 8:02 p.m. University United Methodist Church in Irvine, California. And my other problem is something called image management. I may feel like shit, but I have to look just right. And that's not enough. The person next to me has to be right enough because all of you out there judging me based on the company I keep. I heard Dr. Paul say, he says, I'm not much, but that's all I think about in my case. Not only am I thinking about me, but I think all of you have no life, so you're all thinking about me. And you're constantly judging me. That's called insanity, and I didn't know it. So anyway, I'll just tell you how it was, what happened, and how it is today. Keep it very simple. How it was I grew up, and first of all, it's ironic that I've been asked to be a Sunday morning speaker. Those of you who heard my tape refuse to let me speak on a Sunday morning. So you didn't. You see, you're Mrs. Robinson. Yeah, you like that. I like to do this stuff, a little different. I'm only teasing, you know that. But anyway, I grew up in the wonderful city of Bombay, India, left the shores of India in 1974 at the tender age of 22, which makes me just a tad over 50 and a half. Anyway, and you know, I never come across this disease called alcoholism. Now, that's called really being in deep denial because we lost an uncle to this crazy disease of alcoholism. He died of the cirrhosis of the liver, blind in both eyes, barely able to move. I recall I was told that his wife literally dropped him off an almost stopped vehicle outside another uncle's store. I guess she was practicing the art of detachment. It was geographic distancing. Out of sight, out of mind, I don't want to deal with this guy. Well, we never attributed what he had to alcoholism. We thought he was morally decrepit, that he lacked in willpower, because he had a few other things happening about him. He lived in the wrong part of town. God forgive him for that. He hung around with the wrong element of women. He smoked a lot, gambled a lot, and he drank a lot. So, and his addictions come in clusters. He had them all. And we never thought it was a disease. And actually, I was in my sixth grade, we call them here, and I found out that my headmaster, the vice principal of my school, had founded the first chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous in Bombay, India. And I asked a friend of mine, I said, what the heck is AA? He said, oh, they get drunks off the street and get them sober. Literally, ironically, AA came to my rescue, at least figuratively, in getting my now former spouse off the so-called street and getting her sober. And I was married 17 years, she was drunk the first 3.5 years. And I'll tell you that story as we go along, what happened. Anyway, I left Bombay, India after I graduated. I walked up the proverbial mountain to my guru. I said, oh, great one, I seek serenity. He said, go to Detroit, Michigan, and join Al-Anon. The bastard neglected to tell me I had to marry an alcoholic in the process. I'm kidding, there's no guru, none of that stuff. But as I left India, I was warned by well-meaning friends and family. They said, do not get involved with American women. Canadians are okay. And I said, why? And they said, oh, they drink and smoke in the open like men. Translation, discreet Indian women do it behind closed doors, for God's sake. Now, I did not care if the American woman smoked. Kissing an ashtray was really not a problem. But I liked the fact that the American woman drank, because it says, candy is dandy, but liquor's quicker. It made my progress in an evening extremely cost-effective and expedient. I identified with the MASH character, Alan Alden MASH is my kind of woman, drunk. I say, I like that. And that's what happened. I lived in Southfield, Michigan at the time, actually Troy. And I had finished up with Wayne State in Detroit, and I was working for Xerox, and I was a part-time lecturer at Wayne State. And I used to hang around these meat markets in the suburbs of Detroit, and I used to lure the women from the suburbs to downtown Detroit, because it was quite an adventure to come down to downtown Detroit. And downtown Detroit had a place called Greektown. I don't know if you've been to the Detroit area. Greektown is an extremely safe place. It's because it's policed by the Greek mafia. And so you're very safe at 4 in the morning. But what was nice about Greektown is you could bring these ladies over for dinner. And dinner in those days, back in the 70s, at Greektown was like $25-$30 for a four-course meal that included something called Roditas wine. And Roditas wine had this quality of transforming an absolute stranger into the best of friends over the course of an evening. And I loved it. Drink some more, please. Have fun. Oopa, you know that stuff. You know, I told my wife when I married, and she was found out she was an alcoholic after she married me. I drove her to drink. Some of her friends and family said, Susie never did that till you married her. Yeah, I drove her to drink. But I told my wife, I said, God, you know, I was in these relationships. And you know, first of all, I want to put a caveat here. I was a cad, somewhat of a cad. I'm less of a cad today. I was an arrogant, banal, narcissistic, self-centered human being at the time. I'm less so today. So I want to put that up front. Some of the story, some of the women recall, oh God, what a prick. Yes, I was. I was. I didn't know that at the time. I was. And I'm less so today. And I'm painfully aware of it when the prick shows up every now and then. So I'm standing there, and I tell my wife, I said, geez, I went out with all these ladies, and I had these relationships. Now, relationships in those days for me is really taking the expression to its ultimate. A week and a half was about the extent of my relationships. And I said, you know what? We Al-Anons carry a little beam in our head. Alcoholic, no, don't waste your time. She doesn't need taken care of. Alcoholic, no, move on, move on, move on, move on. I said, when I met you, my beam took off, and your beam took off, and we got married. She said, nonsense. If you'd married one of them, you would have driven them to drink too, like you did me. So this keeps going on and on. So anyway, image management is what created my situation here. And I said, my God's a God of irony. It's a God of humor. And I had come to seek serenity in Detroit, Michigan. By George, I was going to find it. And I remember my boss at the time at Xerox was having a party, and I was dating this one woman who did not fit the image I wanted to present at this party, so I was seeking the right image. And I walk into this little student hangout called Traffic Jam, and this woman who's working her way through nursing school comes and waits at our table. She fits the image I want to ask to this party. My beam takes off, her beam takes off. I ask her out, and she says yes. And she tells me, and my ego lets me believe it, when she said, "Oh, you're the first patron that I've ever gone out with." So I ask her out to this party. Before we go to the party, we're going to get to know each other a bit. So we stop for dinner. Now this is where all the signs came in. I mean, God was just sending me all kinds of signals. Run, 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 because you're going to be in trouble here. But no. We sit to eat, and normally when I ate with a woman, I listened with an open mind, in one ear, out the other. Because I'm strategizing, right? See, the guys can identify, and the women are nodding, yes, we know. In this case, I was actually indulging in intellectual intercourse. I'm talking to this woman and listening and retaining what she's saying, and I'm involved in a conversation. I should have left her at the dinner table, gotten my car, driven away. But no, I was going to find this thing called serenity, and we find it at this party. At this second warning comes in the form of George, a buddy of mine. He walks up and he says, "Oh, you and Susan look so comfortable together. How long have you been going out?" 7, 8, 9 years. I said, "George, I met this woman last week. This is our first day." He says, "Man, you look very comfortable together. Must be a past life thing." Had to put that stereotypical stuff in there. I should have left her at the party and driven away, but no, we continued to now get into a relationship. About 4 months into our relationship, there was a knock on the door on a weekday evening. It was about 10 o'clock, I believe. I opened the door, and out stands this woman with a lump on her head. And I said, "What happened?" She said, "My mother struck me in an alcoholic rage." Now, the knight in me, the shining armor in me, the knight in shining armor in me, the father. I could have been like Mick Jagger in Emotional Rescue. You know, "You will not go back to that woman." I said, "You will move in with me." Now, a Hindu from Bombay, India, does not ask a Polish Catholic girl to move in. Now, that wasn't the scary part. The scary part was watching her God-fearing, very Catholic mother who disavowed sinful relationships in terms of living together without the benefit of marriage, actually helping her daughter move in with me. That should have been a clue that something was awry in Michigan. When you watch mother and daughter moving this furniture up into my house, into my apartment. I should have left mother and daughter in my apartment, driven away, but no. For God's sake, I was going to find this thing called serenity. Now, you know, this strange thing started to happen. Now, you might say that I was in denial. For me, denial is actually a progression. I was clueless. I mean, you have to be clueless, then you get into some sort of awareness, then you get into denial, then you get into more awareness and the acceptance. So I was really in a state of cluelessness. And the reason for that I've recognized retrospectively is that I lacked any depth to my personality. I was sociopathic to some extent. You were only in my life if you were of some use to me. I didn't know all of this stuff while I'm in the midst of it because, of course, I'm clueless. I'm so outwardly focused that I have no sense of what's going on inside of me. And I'll give you an example of that. When I came into Al-Anon and I was at my men's stag group and the men were talking about feelings, that was very scary to begin with. And I'm sitting listening to this thing called feelings. I've never experienced a feeling. And one day I'm driving in my car after a meeting. I'm sipping on a soda and I start to feel a welling in my chest. I said, "Oh God, I'm experiencing a feeling." And I said, "Am I happy?" "Yeah, I'm happy, but it's not overwhelming. So why am I feeling the sense of overwhelmingness?" And he says, "Are you feeling sad?" "No, there's nothing sad going on." So I don't. And all of a sudden I feel the carbon dioxide escape and the wellingness is gone, and I said, "Oh God, it wasn't a feeling, it was just a little bit of gas in there." This is how disconnected this person was sitting in that place in Royal Oak, Michigan. So when your wife is displaying all these symptoms of a disease that's in the process of happening, I have no clue. I have absolutely no clue. So we're having problems here and there. We decided the only way to solve problems is to take the next step, which is to get married. We did. We moved to this wonderful condo in a town called Warren, Michigan. And if you're from Warren, Michigan, of course, be grateful, unless you're from Saskatchewan. Oh, geez. I'm giving Marge a hell of a time this weekend. She still took my card for some reason. I guess she's going to send me a letter bomb or something. And you know, clues came galore in this little townhome. We had this little half bathroom, and I'd go into the half bathroom, open up the cabinet, six or seven empty cans of beer would topple out. And I was not upset about six or seven empty cans of beer being in the bathroom. I was upset that they were not in the trash can. Now, this is called being anal. I'd walk out to my wife and say, what were those empty cans of beer doing all strewn about in the cabinet? She said, oh, Aunt Bunny came over and had a few beers. I never questioned her why Aunt Bunny would come to the bathroom with a six-pack. Was she eliminating the middleman? I don't know. And I swear to you, I have not gotten the answer to this. A friend of mine comes over. I said, would you like a glass of wine? He said, sure. I reach into the cabinet to pull out this bottle of wine. It's got the cork in it. It's got this wrap around. It's got the red seal in it, but it's empty. Do they have special stores for alcoholics to mess with Al-Anon minds? Say, here's a syringe. Just pull the wine out so many cc's at a time and blow their mind. So one day, image management again came to my rescue. My family had moved into the area, and Sue happened to be the white sheep of the family, and I was going to introduce her for the first time. And I'm driving with her to visit this family, and all of a sudden, she gets into this rip-roaring royal spat with me, and I smell something. I still hadn't developed my Al-Anon nose at that time. And so I said, I can't take you in this condition. I'm going to drop you back off at home. So we drove back to the house. She goes inside, and I go to the kitchen for a reason. I'm passing this half bathroom, and she's trying to shut the door to this cabinet. And they say it's a disease of perception because I glanced into that cabinet, and it was a 55-gallon drum of Gallo wine. It was actually a half a gallon jug. And all my cluelessness, all my denial, all my lack of awareness sort of dissipated in one cataclysmic moment. I just stood there quietly, and a little voice just jumped into my head and said, your wife's an alcoholic. Because see, all the stuff that I'd been seeing, that I'd been pretending hadn't happened, or not even pretending, unaware it was happening, all of it just came in. And the voice said, you know what, now we don't need one of you. Because you will think her thoughts, you will feel her feelings, you will experience her emotions. You're going to have conversations with her, she's going to respond, you're going to talk back to her. All this is going to happen, but she's not going to be there because it's all going to happen here. They say the mind is a place of its own, making hell of heaven and heaven of hell. Mine was just, I mean, Milton could have written Paradise Lost and Paradise Gained and everything else in here, and I would have said it's okay because it's all happening in my head. All these conversations, all these fights. And if I had been able to morph God into a human form, said, God, you're full of, you know what, that's not going to happen to me because I'm individuated. I'm not so, pardon the psychobabble term, enmeshed into this woman. That's never going to happen. I was wrong because that's exactly what happened for the next 3.5 years. And this is a strange thing. This is really shows how illogical and insane my thinking was at the time and still can be. I had seen the Schick Schedel commercials. Because see, the first time I recognized my wife had a drinking problem, the voice that popped into my head after all this other stuff that came and said, I'll figure this out and we'll straighten it out. And I'd been watching these Schick Schedel commercials. I don't know if you have them up here. They used to have them in Detroit. And the Schick Schedel commercial was a wife goes up to her husband. She says, sweetheart, you have a drinking problem. And he looks at her and says, darling, you're so right. And then they go off to get treated. So this kid believed in the truth and advertising clause. So I walk up to my wife and said, sweetheart, you have a drinking problem. She said, you're an idiot. I don't. I had no plan B. And plan B was something called, I said, logic. Now that's a male myth, logic. I think that's been foisted upon us by you women who manipulate us into believing we have logic and you control us that way. So I figured if I catch her in the act, then she'll know, I'll know, and she'll be confronted with the facts, and so she'll have to stop drinking. So if you're new to Al-Anon, you've got a drunk in your life. By the way, why do we call them practicing? Mine had perfected the art. I don't use the word active alcoholic either. There's nothing active about this woman. She was either sedentary, sat there on the couch and made my life miserable because I stood there and watched her sit on the couch and get drunk. Anyway, so I figured if I catch her in the act, she'll stop and it'll all happen. So I used to sit on this couch. I didn't have much of a life and a lot of time on my hands. I'd sit on the couch pretending to do the crossword. What's a 5-letter word for boredom? Anui, E-N-N-U-I. Some of you are experiencing it right now. And I'm watching this reflection on a blank television set. It's not on, so I can see what's going on in the kitchen. How smart. Very smart. So watch a pour of booze, which is something alcoholics do rather well, at least the active ones. And I make this Archimedean exclamation, aha! Like I've discovered a new law in physics. She's pouring booze, and I'm finding the theory of gravity or something here. And I say, now I know what to do. And she'd crawl up with some semblance of dignity, her nose held high as she did it. I'm exaggerating a tad, of course, it was down. And I'd get up and I'd move the bottles around, thinking that now she'll know when she gets up for her 2 o'clock feed time, that's he knows. So 2 o'clock, I'd sit up with her, because it's now feed time for the baby. She comes down, and I hear this clang clang going on again. And I'm saying, aha! Now she knows. I didn't realize that alcoholics in good standing have their booze in 16,000 places. But if they forget, they know, you know, stretch your hand this way, you'll find it, stretch your hand that way. And she'd come and beat the crap out of me, and I'd be pretending to be asleep. What a way to live. Then I walked up to her, I said, you know what? You really have a drinking problem. She said, no, we have a marriage problem. I'm Polish Catholic and you're not. I said, very profound observation. I would never have come to that conclusion. Sarcasm was another weapon of mine that I used quite frequently, and I have made amends for it since. You know, say sarcasm is to tear flesh, because that's the weapon I used. I wasn't physical or violent. Physically, you know, I'm sure she would have hoped I was, because my tongue, I had the command of the language, and I could strip her down one side to the other with my sarcasm. This is just an ugly, ugly thing that I did. You're tearing the spirit of a person. I've made amends since, and that's, you know, even though I miss sometimes having that witty repartee, it's just so obvious when someone comes at you and opens the door for something really, and I know it just damages me more than it does the other, so I kind of cut that out of my life, and I'm great. It's just been removed more. Most of it has been removed. But anyway, going back to the thing, she said, we need to see a marriage counselor. I said, I'll get one. But I'll be in control. So I called a guy up who's not a marriage counselor so much as he is an alcohol treatment guy. And I go through this litany of what she's been doing over the last X number of months, and I said, I'm going to bring her in, and you take one look at her, and you say, you're an alcoholic. And you strap her to the bedpost, and you put whatever stuff you put down their throats to get them sober. See, I didn't know the meaning of the word sobriety. To me, she needed to drink only 2 glasses of white wine, specifically Chardonnay. When she exceeded that, it made life miserable for me. It made it very embarrassing for me. They say you can spot the behavior of an alcoholic. You can spot an alcoholic from the behavior of the person next to them. I'd be sitting in a restaurant with this woman, and my buddy would look at me and say, Ajit, what's your problem? I said, what's my problem? She's got mozzarella dripping down her chin. She's got pepperoni on her eyebrows. And you're asking me what my problem is. He said, oh, she's having a great time. And she was. This is the idiot who's sitting there so focused on this person, and I didn't know that I had choices and I had options and I had ways to lead my life without being so engulfed with this disease. So here I am. I call this counselor up. We go see this counselor. And despite all my instruction to him, I guess they teach them one question in psych 101 that they have to use for the rest of their lives. He said, so, what's the problem? In my mind, I say, you moron, I trained you over the phone, 30 minutes. So I said, oh, she drinks too much. And he's making notes, she's crying. To make a long story short, he lets us go on an outpatient basis. She said, I'll find a counselor. We go see another counselor who had been to school with the first counselor, because we walk in and he says, so, what's the problem? I said, my wife drinks too much. So he says, so, what's the problem? And I thought he had a problem with my accent, so I spoke louder and slower. Like he's deaf and stupid. So he says, so, what's the problem? Meaning, what's the problem with that? And I swear to you, if you turn the lights off in that room, his nose shone so red, he could have served as a beacon on a dark ocean guiding ships. I mean, Rudolph wouldn't have borrowed his nose. I looked at her, I said, oh my God, he's one of you. She said, oh no, he understands. And he did. For the next 3 weeks, he understood and then never showed up again. He disappeared, and I'm sure he disappeared into a blackout someplace. Maybe he wasn't even a therapist. I don't know. So that didn't work. So I said, you know what? I have an option here. I have choices. I can leave. I don't have to be in this marriage. So I packed up my worldly belongings into a polka-dotted little cloth, put it on a stick, and like Porky Pig, I was going to move the house. I'm leaving. And she said, if you leave, I will commit suicide. I said, that I want to watch so you don't botch it up. So I follow her from the door to the kitchen, which is only about 15 nanoseconds in a little town home, and her intentions changed from suicide to homicide. I don't know how that happened. So I'm here and she's about there in the kitchen, and I'm here and there's a TV set behind me, and all of a sudden here come the dishes flying at me at 90 miles an hour. I mean, this woman missed a calling. She should have been a Major League Baseball pitcher someplace, because these things are flying at about 95 miles an hour. And this image-conscious idiot is tossing the dishes and sort of running out of the house. Why don't I run out of the house? Because I don't want my neighbors to find out that I have a drunk at home. That brings me to the question, why do alcoholics become anonymous after they get sober? You know, if you're anonymous when you're drinking, no problem. Just stay home in a dark, dank room, get drunk, pass out, die. I don't care. But don't make my life miserable because my neighbors are going to think that I'm the idiot. But I am the idiot. See, I just don't want to accept the fact I'm an idiot. That didn't work, so I figured she has fatal attraction. So I'm going to take the next course of action. I'm going to kill her. I come from the land of Gandhi, right? You're supposed to... you're supposed to starve yourself in front of the other person. They say if Gandhi had been in Italy, India would still be under the influence of the British. Italian food is hard to pass, you know, give up. You say, Parmesan, forget it. Let the British stay. I'm reading this. This is all happening in nanoseconds in my head. I'm reading this English magazine called Argosy, and Alfred Hitchcock has a story, and it describes the perfect murder weapon. I see a few people kind of straining forward. And it's an icicle. It disappears, and the deepest of all, tells the man, just disappears. So I figure this February, the icicle's dangling out. I'm going to take it. I'm going to kill her. I'm going to go to the basement, dig it up, pour fresh cement. This is all happening in 15 nanoseconds. And then it occurred to me that my wife's car is parked outside in the carport. My mother-in-law lives about a mile and a half, 2 miles away. She'll come over, she'll find dust on this car, she'll call the police. And I did not come to the United States to befriend some guy named Bugger in a Michigan prison. Being traded for cigarettes was not an option. So I'm really, now I'm guilty, feeling guilty for even contemplating this heinous thing. And I shared about this in my Friday night meeting one time in Irvine, and a woman walked up to me and she said, oh, I'm so glad you shared your story because I've been so guilty about this. And I said, why? She said, my husband was passed out on the couch and I was going to take a pillow and snuff him out. And I said, why did you not follow through with your thought? And she said, in her thinking, she said, God, that's a terrible thing to even contemplate, or it's a heinous thing to do. Instead, she said, oh, they would have found cotton in his nose and they would have known I've done it. Now we refer to the alcoholic with the problem. Finally, the twins came to my rescue. I'm not talking the Norwegian bobsled team or anything like that. It was Dear Abby and Ann Landis. I'm a man of the 80s and the 90s. So I do believe that. God, Al-Anon has developed my feminine side in me so much that I'm not dating myself. I don't need a woman in my life. I snuggle with myself and actually listen to myself. That's so sick. Anyway. So it says, if you're mother or father or whatever of an alcoholic, go to Al-Anon. I said, finally, someone's going to tell me how to get this woman sober. So say it's the disease of perceptions. I've walked into my first Al-Anon meeting in Warren, Michigan. It was brightly lit as this, but in my mind, it was a dark, dingy room. There were six women in their average age deceased. That's it. That was my perception. They were about as old as I am. Beautiful women. But at that time, in my 20s, I'm looking at this and, oh my God. So I walk up to the deadest of them all, because she looked like she had the most authority in her. And I said, how does this bloody thing work? And she was just, she wouldn't even get up to give me a hug. She said, go to that table. It was a literature table. And there's a pamphlet there. And you pick up that pamphlet and you read it. And that's how we work this program. So I walk up to this thing, and I pick up this pamphlet, and my logical, pseudo-logical mind says, oh, 12 steps. And there's an escape clause at the top. It says, these steps have been taken from Alcoholics Anonymous. We change one word in the 12th step. We say others. So some apply to me, some don't. Click, click, step 13, she gets sober. Now I know what step 13 is. I didn't know at the time. So I sit down and I'm reading. First step, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. And I said, my life isn't unmanageable. Now unmanageable people, people's lives are manageable, don't go around critiquing your drunk's choice of alcohol from what they find in the garbage can. You come home and your wife is laying on the floor, there's stuff coming out of her mouth. A kid from across the neighborhood can say, man, that woman is drunk because I smell booze. But no, this idiot actually is propelled to the garbage can and I'm pulling out and saying, Kmart champagne, how gauche. And she's pulled out red wine and it's got a screw top. She didn't let it breathe. How could she drink this stuff? How snobbish can you get? Your wife's passed out, and I talked to my sponsor, said, oh God, Don, I was pursuing a degree in garbology, and my sponsor, I guess they send them to one-upmanship school. He said, oh, that is nothing. I said, what do you mean that's nothing? He says, man, I used to work in the army with a flashlight in my mouth. I used to fix jeeps in the night because it was all dark, and that trait came in real handy. I could put a flashlight in my mouth and go through two garbage cans at the same time. I didn't have the heart to tell him you could go to an industrial supply shop with a helmet, you know. Took the second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. In my case, introduction would have been the appropriate term, but I said, I'm the sane one, she's the insane one. Sane people don't go about contemplating homicide. I didn't see that way, see? Step three, made a decision to turn our lives now and our wills over to the care of God as we understood Him. I said, I went to 12 years of Catholic school. They told me God helps those who help themselves. And why give to Him that which He's given to us in the first place? That would make God an Indian giver. I can say that. So. I took a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself and God. I qualified for sainthood. No defects of character. That's called denial. Now, that's pure denial. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. That step goes against the credo of image management. One, there was nothing wrong. Two, if there was something wrong with me, and if God didn't know what kind of a God was that, and if there was something wrong with me, you were never going to find out. Are you nuts? What you don't know cannot hurt you. Move on. Step six, made a list of all my defects of character. There were none to make. Step seven, humbly asked Him. I was so humble, I was proud of it. There was really, humility was a foreign concept. Step eight, laid a list of persons I had harmed. They deserved it. Nine, I'm still waiting for her to make amends to me. I continued to take personal inventory. My head was hurting because the halo was fitting too tight. And the gossamer wings were starting to sprout, so I looked at the lady, and I looked at step 11, saw through prayer and meditation. I was making deals with God all the time. God, get a kill. Six Hail Marys. Make sure no one else is killed. That's 12 Hail Marys. I go home crying every day to my God. Oh, God, I hope she's passed out. Oh, God, I hope she's passed out. Oh, God, I hope she's passed out. I get home, she's passed out. I said, damn it, she's passed out. Then I'd get into my car and drive where? To a single spa. Why? I got a drunk at home. Why am I shopping for more? I don't know. I go to the bar. I order a drink. I have a cigar in my hands that smells so wicked no woman in a 30-mile radius wants to come close to me. I cuss the drink, cuss the cigar, cuss the place, cuss everyone, go home crying. I hope she's passed out. What a bloody way to live. And I looked at this woman and I said, now what? I'm spiritually awake in 3.5 minutes. That's a record. What do I do? And she said those three words that I hated for the longest time. She said, keep coming back. I said, why? She said, because you're sick. And she said with such emphasis, she just spit the word out. I said, I'm not sick. The sick one's at home. She said, no, you're sick. You better come back. So I did, every 6 weeks. You're going to embark on a program, literally, that's going to get to the psyche of the core of your psyche. There's a little screw in there that distorts perceptions unless it's set right. So it's going to now, this program is going to get into a deep psyche and it's going to turn that screw just enough so your perception starts to get altered. So your attitudes start to change, your behavior starts to change, you're going to become a different person, if you will, and your actions are going to demonstrate that, and you're going to do this by going to class every 6 weeks. And you know, Al-Anon messed me up in my thinking. See, I'm a pseudo-intellectual. I got about 15,000 thoughts swirling at any time into my head, trying to find answers to questions that don't even need to be answered. And you messed it up. You said, alcoholism is like a disease. And that disease is like cancer. So don't leave her because she has cancer. Would you leave? You know that pamphlet we read, The Alcoholic Speaks to His Family. Personally, I think it's the biggest piece of fiction. Have you ever heard your alcoholic say those things to you? Never. But so anyway, he said, it's a disease like cancer, it's a disease like diabetes. And my head, you know, the second thought jumps up and says, this other body in there, this committee going on, says, if it's like cancer, why isn't she seeking chemotherapy? If it's like diabetes, why not insulin therapy? And so all this noise going on. And no one explained to me that this disease transcends the concepts of physiological and physical definitions of disease and enters the realms of psychological and spiritual realms of disease. It wasn't until I was transferred to Chicago, I went to a meeting in Schaumburg, Illinois, and please, I'm not suggesting you do this at your meetings. I was chastised in one conference for even suggesting this is my story, this is what they did to me in Schaumburg, Illinois, at an Al-Anon meeting. And I was talking about this disease and said, I don't accept this disease concept, I don't know what the hell is it. And they said, you want to know what this disease is all about, go to the text. And in an Al-Anon meeting, they had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I walk up and they had me read that book. And we'd have discussions on this thing called disease. Today, if you walk up to me and say, is alcoholism a disease? I say, I don't know and I don't care because that's not my problem. My problem is obsessing with the behavior of the person because when the booze was removed, I found myself obsessing over other stuff. I'm the kind of guy, I'm exaggerating this a tad, but gives you a glimpse into my nature, my potential, if you will, because it's dormant now. I'm on a date with a beautiful woman. She could be drop-dead gorgeous sitting across from me, but God help her if she's got a piece of lettuce stuck in a tooth. The woman disappears and this lettuce now is my friend. I want to take a toothpick and I want to take a, you know, floss. Alcohol had literally dominated my perception. This woman had disappeared. She was a wonderful artist, a terrific cook, a beautiful human being. She disappeared. All that stood in front of me was this big bottle of booze. I'm in my shower recently. I'm showering. Not I shower every day, but this story is about something recent. It's got a big white tiles on the wall, and on the wall is a little tiny black ant that was stuck to the tile. And I swear to you, within so many minutes, I'm just standing, then the wall disappeared, and this ant's there, and I'm saying, how did the ant get stuck? And I'm tossing water. It says, what kind of protein comes out of this that causes it to adhere to the surface so tight? It's like the problem has now dominated my thinking, that the solutions have completely eluded me. The wall had disappeared. All that stood in front of me is this little black ant. That's the way I think, and I call alcoholism a disease. I don't know. It doesn't really, not my problem if it's a disease or not a disease. I'm the guy who wants to drive four cars on the freeway at times. The idiot in front of me is only doing 100. The fool behind me wants to ride in my back seat, and the guy in the blind spot doesn't let me cut in front of the guy in front of me. And then I question myself why my life is unmanageable, not because the alcoholic drinks. It's because of the way I think and the way I perceive life and the way I create my reality and the way I respond to situations in my life. And that's where it's all about. But I'm going to tell you, just because I came to the program in the 80s does not mean that the program got a hold of me. Because you see, I'm the kind of person who, when he reads something, thinks he knows it. And just because he thinks he knows it, he believes he's experienced it. And that's when the falsehood comes into play. So there was a meeting on honesty last night. And I've come to the conclusion for myself, when I open my mouth, I'm lying unless I back it up with action. And my program was a big lie for the first 7-8 years because it was caught up in this little thing here, in this little area, and it just bounced around all the concepts. I could talk on this program. I could philosophize on the steps. I actually had a suggestion or two for Bill W. had me around in terms of how to position the steps a little bit differently so they would make more sense. That's not arrogance, that's just pragmatics. You know how it works. And I was doing all the stuff and I crashed. I started a new business. My spouse had been sober 2.5 years and we had twins, the first go around, immaculately conceived. We call them Jesus. I'm teased. And then we have the two more kids. But after the twins were born, I'd started a new business. We moved into a new house. We'd been transferred to California. And I found a partner who preferred women and wine over clients and reports and invoicing and what have you. So things were going to hell in a handbasket after the first year. I was equally responsible for being negligent in that area because I was trying to start a few other things without paying attention to what was going on. Occasionally I found myself paying my mortgage with my credit card, not a good thing to do. And I was desperate. I got on my knees and I said, "Oh God, help." And I closed my eyes and reached into my wife's bookshelf, and out in my hands jumped out this big book again of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I opened it up, just kind of blindly opened it up, and opened up to the third step. And it's like Tyson had walked out of his Indiana prison at the time and just hit me in the face and said, "You have not surrendered. You merely submitted. You're still indulging in all this plotting and planning and scheming, and you have not let go." And letting go has always been, conceptually has been a struggle for me in that sense, because I always viewed myself as handing something over to someone else's. God's given me all these faculties, all these abilities, and all this stuff that I have. Why do I keep having to turn things over to Him? Why can't I create my own reality? And realized for myself today that I do turn my will and my life over to the care of God. It's my understanding of God that has changed. And I heard this beautiful story this man the other day was saying in this one meeting I went to. And he said this one guy was coming into town. And as he walked into the town, outside the town was this tree, and under the tree was this absolutely beautiful creature, little animal. It was an absolutely wonderful red. And the red was just so different. It was unique. It shone so brilliantly. And he was absolutely taken by it, and he goes into the town, and he goes to the coffee shop, and he describes this animal he's seen, this little creature, and everyone's rather taken by it. Suddenly another guy shows up, and he's listening to the story, and says, "You know what? I saw the same animal, you're absolutely right, very beautiful, except the animal was blue." So they start to have a disagreement, it was red or blue, and instead, third guy shows up, he says, "Oh, geez, you're both wrong, I saw the same animal, the animal is yellow." And so they get into this big war, as we all do when we disagree with each other. We get into fisticuffs and fight with each other. And so we get up, the coffee shop owner says, "Why are you three fighting? Let's go out and take a look for ourselves." And all of them go to the outskirts of the town. They go to the tree. The creature is missing, and there's a man standing there. And they say, "Excuse me, did you see a creature here?" The first guy says, "It was beautiful. It was red." And the guy said, "Yes, I did." And the second guy says, "You know what? I saw the creature. He was yellow." He says, "You're absolutely right. It was yellow." He says, third guy says, no, it was blue." He says, "You're absolutely right. It was blue." He says, "Wait a minute, it can't be red and he can't be blue and he can't be yellow at the same time." He says, "Yes, it is. It's a chameleon." And what the guy was trying to say in this meeting was that's our perception of God is so integral to us and how we view it. I can't impose that upon you. I can't share my experience of surrender to you. You have to experience it for yourself. I figured by reading it, I would understand it, therefore I've experienced it. I did not know that. And I was sharing yesterday in one of your workshops, I met this ex-nun who happens to be a member of AA, and she put it absolutely wonderfully to me. She said, "Imagine yourself being a stream, you're coming along, and you're getting to the ocean, and you get stuck at the edge of the desert. You can't go. And this voice comes and says, 'I can change you, and I can take you if you're willing to let go of your form. I can change you into something else and take you to the ocean. Are you prepared to let go?'" And you know, when she told me so and asked me that question, I could feel the tension in my shoulders. Like, are you serious? And I have to realize that today that what I'm surrendering to is not something out there, it's something in here. That there's this, and some people I hear get caught up with this concept called God, and I'm not sitting there and proselytize and give you an evangelical description of what God is. You have to experience that for yourself. To me, it just makes sense that when I'm caught in my own old lack-based, fear-based, poverty-based, whatever-based consciousness, that I'm not letting this wonderful thing inside of me manifest itself. When I surrender myself to this new consciousness that this program gives me, because if you read the steps, which is what I got of steps, they're statements of affirmation. Everything is stated in the past tense. And the 12 steps is having had a spiritual awakening, say, perhaps we will, or maybe we will, or some of us will. It doesn't put any of those caveats. I said, "God, I'm reading these steps and I'm saying, this makes so much sense. The spiritual awakening begins in step one when I allow myself to be absorbed by the experience of the steps." And I didn't know that. I'm working with them here. And I'm theorizing and I'm being very, very technical about it. To make a long story short, it brought me crashing. And I walked up to my sponsor and said, "I'm a fraud. I want to quit." And he, I don't know where he came up with this logic. He said, "If you hadn't been working this program, you would not have come to this conclusion." I said, you don't understand. I talk the talk, I don't walk the walk. I'm not honest in my relationships. I'm not faithful I'm not loyal to my other relationships, my marriage and what have you. I haven't shown fidelity every which way. I have not been honest in my dealings in the cash register sense, in my taxes and all the other stuff that I do, or with clients. I tell lies when it suits me. But when I walk into those meetings that people are asking me to sponsor, and I'm telling my wonderful story, and I'm articulating on these concepts, and everyone thinks I'm actually working the program. I believe I'm working on the program. I mean, I hear when I share, I think I'm the most profound person in that meeting. That's really scary. It's false. But he said, no, I want you to stick around. And for the first time, I said, help me, what do I do? He said, go back to the first step. Don't stand there and say you're powerless over people, places, and institutions just because you've heard 15 other people say that. Are you really powerless over the situation? Be site-specific. Read from the big book, the little book, the green book, the blue book, the one day at a time, all the other books. The concept of powerlessness, what is it? And to me today, the first step is really a Zen statement. It is thus. Just the way it is. It's raining. It's dry. It's not good. It's not bad. It just is. Because he said that allows you to define the problem. You define the problem because your problem is not the alcoholic. It's your perception. See, this is scary for a pseudo-intellectual because when you start talking perceptions, all your reality is getting distorted now. I'm driving in my car. I'm saying, admitting the existence of a perceived reality. That's step one. But what if your perceptions are off? Then is your reality really your reality? Is it not your reality? So I stop thinking. I call up my sponsor because thinking is dangerous for me. Because I'm always constantly trying to find this unifying principle. Why this? Why not that? Why not this? Why not that? And really on an everyday, regular basis has really no meaning in that regard unless I meet up with Socrates and Plato or any of those guys, sit and sip on great wine, eat grapes and talk about the whys and wherefores of life. All I know today is today, as your slogan says, each day a new beginning. I get up every morning as long as I don't hear that same song as they had in that movie with Bill, what's his name? You know what I'm talking about, the Groundhog Day? Every day the same old churning and I'm doing the same old crap and it's not changing. And my sponsor said, I said, okay, now define the problem, now what? He says, step two of wonderful options. It tells you your options. What are my options? Because when you stop focusing on the problem and you start focusing on the solution, all of a sudden, and you want to try this in your own lives if you want it, I'm sure you have, when you start, we move in the direction of our dominant thoughts. If I'm dominating my thoughts on solutions, what happens? They're starting to click in my head. A guy gave me an experiment, he said, think of an apple and see what thoughts come out when you start thinking of an apple. All of a sudden, I found myself in Virginia at my sister's home eating apple pie and having a discussion. All the stuff about apples just started jumbling into my head. Step three, we talked about, was a trip for me, and today I'm feeling more and more comfortable with step three. I'm not going to tell you that every move I make is, all right, God, there's still this Don Quixote trying to fight windmills. Step four was, I took the four column thing, but step four, my program really came into play in 1997, 17 years after I'd started in Al-Anon. The lie finally ended, and it ended because of a relationship. My wife one day, 8 or 9 years into her sobriety, came to the awareness that something had happened to her in her childhood by people who were very important to her father, her priest, some other people, and that really altered the course of our relationship. The intimacy disappeared, the physical end, and it became intellectual and spiritual, and even that sort of went away. And we were two strangers living in a house with four kids, sleeping in separate rooms. She finally had the courage to get up and say, this is over. And I suddenly channeled a 75-year-old Jewish guy. I said, oy vey, I put up with you for 17 years, and I... And OJ showed up, and I've got this cleaver going, and I'm screaming and yelling. And I want to take her to the court, and I want to drill orifices in her body that she would not even imagine could happen to her. I'm sitting across this attorney, this barracuda, who's charging me $250 because we're going to prove to the world that my wife is neurotic, psychotic, incapable of raising children, incapable of being an owner of a house. She did not deserve to live. And my sponsor shows up on my shoulder, and he's been to school with the first two therapists. He said, so, what's the problem? define the problem. Perception. She wants to leave me. My perception tells me she doesn't want me to have the kids. That was never mentioned in the whole situation. I said, I don't want to lose my kids. And he said, have you asked her if she's going to take you away from the kids? Oh God, details. No, I haven't. I know. I know. I walk in, I look at you, I know all about you. That's what I think. So I base everything else, I never question my own reality by saying, is it true? Is it really true? And is it really, really, really true? Because I know everything I see is a lie to me, unless I question myself as to the motives of what's prompting my perception. So I look at I think it's my sponsor on my shoulder. I don't know how he came in on my shoulder in the attorney's office. I said, no, I have not. He said, why don't you call her? So tell the attorney I'm not going to do it. I get out and I call my wife on the cell phone. I said, I'm not taking you to court on one condition. She said, what? I said, I don't want to lose the kids. She said, we have 4 kids. You're a terrible husband. You're a terrific father. I'm not an idiot. I don't want all four of them to myself. Of course they're going to be in your life. Make a long story short, I never went to court. My divorce cost me $700 just for the paperwork. I left the house with 2 bags. I didn't care about the stuff. And that's the best thing I could have done to my kids. And best thing she could have done. Her program clicked in. She was very, very generous on the arrangements. And I was very giving on my end because of the program. My kids were well served. And every crisis that's happened, nothing to the extent of what Marge was talking about, God Almighty, what a phoenix. And I really commend the program for what has happened. Mine pales in comparison. But every crisis that's happened in my life has been a blessing. I was a good father in the sense I went to the soccer games, I refereed and I did this and I played ball with my kids and all that other crap. But I really did not participate at the mundane level, going shopping with them for clothes or doing this or doing that. The very first time I'm divorced, I'm separated, my wife says, it's your turn to take them preschool shopping. So I take 4 kids in tow, 9 shops. Now you would have thought I would have hated every moment. No, I loved it. I have one daughter, I have twins, 8, now soon to be 18-year-olds. 16, when my daughter turned 16, my hair turned gray. But I actually enjoyed my kids. I'm here going shopping with them. My daughter calls me and says, Dad, I need this or I need that, and we're going to do things together. I never in any suit, any clothes, here's the money, or take it out of the checking account, or whatever. This is the first time I'm getting involved. What a blessing, and I didn't realize that. But this is where my 4th came into play, and I'm going to run short on time, so I'm going to hurry up. We started seeing a divorce counselor. We were not looking to stay together. She didn't want to at all. She had moved on. And my counselor advised me, she said, do not get involved in another relationship. For 1 year, I said, relationship? I'm staying away from women as far as I can. I'm moving to the island of Gabos. No, I'm teasing. Not that there's anything wrong with it. Anyway, so I go to my Al-Anon meeting, and there's this very nice lady who has given me the glad eye on occasion. And of course, I enjoyed being around her, but because I was married, never pursued any of that stuff. So after I got divorced, it's 3 months into my separation, and my head starts to take over. It says, you know, you've been going through this marriage, at the end of the marriage, for the last 7 years. Your marriage has been dead. Last 2 years, it's dead. So all the transitional issues have been resolved. It's okay. You can go ahead and have some fun. So I got involved. The woman happened to be from Canada, by the way, the Toronto area. She used to live in Irvine. I tell you, God gives you that which you need at the time you need it, regardless of how it shows up. This was the best damn thing that could have happened to me. I mean, this woman gave me everything that was lacking in the last 7-8 years of my marriage, physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, every which way. It was fantastic, whether we were having dinner in a 5-star restaurant or going shopping at Ralph's. It was fantastic. And as predicted by the counselor, it ended a year later. And it's like someone had thrown bricks into my face. I was hurting real bad because that end hurt me more than my divorce, because the divorce had been happening over a period of time. And I walked up to my sponsor and said, take a gun and shoot me. And he said, why? I said, I'm in terrible pain. I can't take this. And he asked me, my sponsor's a wonderful man. He asked me a very poignant question. He said, when was the last time you've been alone? I said, I can't remember. He said, I think you should lock yourself for a couple of days and work on your 4th. And he pointed me to the one day, the Courage to Change book, page 345. And there are four questions in there that he wanted me to answer. First question was, who am I? I have no idea. I am whatever you want me to be. I'm Zelig in that movie by Woody Allen. If I'm a black jazz artist, I'm a black jazz artist. If I'm a doctor, I'm talking medicine. If I'm with engineers, I'm talking engineering. Whatever you want me to be, I am. I just don't know that because my ego tells me I'm not that way. But I am that way. And the second question was, what are your values? You know, I'd been to Catholic school, taught about values, honesty, this, that, you know, all these virtues. Never ever practice them. You know, you can stand in the garage for 1,000 years, you're never going to become a car, are you? Unless they shove a transmission up your you-know-what. Just by coming to meetings doesn't mean I'm working the program. Just because I read the literature does not mean I'm working the program, because it's all knowledge, it's not experience. Experience is when I start taking those steps and I start to experience those steps. I act through those steps and I start doing the things that the steps suggest I do. The action steps, 3 to 9. And I'm sitting there in this thing and I'm looking at this next question. It's, what traits of character do I wish to keep about me? And the last one was, what traits of character do I wish to get rid of? Steps 4, 6, and 7, all happening in one time. I'm sitting and I'm writing angry letters to my father. He didn't play ball with me. My father didn't know how to hold a cricket bat. Forget it. My father never had to say, I love you, because that's not how he was raised. His way of showing love to me was making sure I had clothes on my back, a roof over my head, and the school to go to. You know, my father and mother never, I don't think, ever got up at 3 in the morning devising means of how to screw up my life. I don't think so. You know, I realized a victim was pouring forth. I'm angry at this and I'm angry at my sisters for not letting me take music when I was a kid. And all this rage is coming out of my ex-wife. See, I pretended in Al-Anon. If I got angry, I got angry for being angry because I didn't want to be angry because I was in program. Now I'm not fighting the battle. I'm fighting the illusion of something beyond it, right? The shadows are what I'm fighting against. I'm hacking at the leaves trying to change the root. Doesn't happen. So I'm working on this thing and it says, who am I? I have no idea. I'm writing, who am I? I'm writing. And all the stuff about my childhood is coming, screaming and crying at myself. I'm going through this major cathartic experience without the benefit of a professional. I'm going nuts in my head and I'm writing this stuff out. Tears are pouring out. I'm done. Now I've written on the traits of character, the values. I had to actually ask my sponsors, what's a value? I, you know, can say everything about values. What's a value? So do you value your children? I said, yes. How do you show that you value your children? What action do you take? Do you value your business? I said, yes. How do you show that? Do you value your friendships? How do you show that? Everything is an action thing. Otherwise, it makes no difference what you think or what you know unless you put it into action. He says, I'm doing all this stuff. At the end of 2 days, Darth Vader shows up and says, welcome to the dark side, because he had denied the dark side. I denied that part of me that was insecure, that was afraid, that was envious, that was all the negatives that I had not embraced and said, this is part of who I am. Because the duality exists. You cannot have the light without the dark. They say you cannot have virtue without vice. None of that would exist. The other didn't exist. You know, I was watching this Star Trek thing. Captain Kirk beeps down and this thing splitter breaks. I see a few engineers kind of lean forward and gladly I'm talking Star Trek. Plastic things are going crazy. And the good Kirk and a bad Kirk. And the good Kirk is a lousy leader and the bad Kirk is a terrific leader. And Kirk calls up Spock. He says, the good Kirk says, I don't understand. Why is this bad Kirk show up like that and he's so good and I can't even lead my way out of a paper bag? And Spock says something that did not make sense at the time. He says, oh, the powers that be give us the good with the bad, so the bad will accentuate the good. And didn't make any sense till I was on the freeway on the 405 and there's a bumper sticker that said, if it weren't for envy, we would not have ambition. It's all a matter of balance, I recognized. And we're talking about this morning. You cannot have enabling without the ability to be caring. You cannot have obsession unless you have the ability to be focused. And so all this thing, you know, step four does not say I'm bad, bad, bad. It just says it is. And now if it is, what do I do with it? I've demonstrated that as I write this stuff down. Saturday morning I do my fifth, and that was the first time after I'd done this 2-day stint, locking myself up for a couple of days, no TV, no radio, no phones, nothing, that I felt my feet actually touch the ground. I heard an AA speaker put it beautifully. He said, my feet were firmly planted in midair. And when I felt that thud, I could look at myself in the mirror and say, you know what, you're okay. You don't have to get all slurpy over yourself and say, I love you. Just okay, just who am I? And I feel more comfortable in my interactions with you. I no longer have to judge you. I can be discerning, but I don't have to be judgmental. I can be compassionate, but I don't have to overwhelm you. And those are the things that start to make sense to me today. I've worked on my steps 8, 5, then 6 and 7. Oh God, what a trip. I'd ignored them for the longest time. And I realized that step 7 is really the gateway to freedom, because I read in my Men's Stag meditation book, it says, one cannot move oneself off the center of one's own endeavor, meaning I by myself cannot remove my defects of character. I ask and invite this wonderful power within me to take this defect of character away from you, this trait of character that no longer serves me, or I'm my fellow man. And that's been beautiful. 8 and 9 I've learned. 8 is I can't walk around saying I'm sorry. That's not an amen. That's an apology. Because my son used to tell me, Dad, you say sorry all the time. You keep doing the same damn thing over and over again. And he's right. And I read someplace it said, there are 2 types of guilt. Neurotic guilt, for which there is no restitution, and real guilt, for which there is restitution. And I've, listening to the members of my meetings, I realize, including myself, we have more of the neurotic guilt. I'm sorry for being even around. No. If I've done wrong, I now have the ability to make restitution and make amends. And that's the gift of this program. This is what the program has given me, and I'm so grateful for it. I won't bore you with the rest of the stuff. It's just a journey that I've enjoyed tremendously in the last 5 or 6 years, because I finally got the entryway into something that makes sense to me. The microcosmic world of Al-Anon is dealing with someone else's drinking. If you want to be detached, don't be in a relationship like I am. I'm totally detached. I don't have relationships. I have my kids. I'm teasing us. Once I'm interacting with someone, I have the tendency to obsess or take over. But the gift of detachment is there, where I can give you the right to be who you are. I was reading this book that's resonated. I've read a few books in the program that have clicked in. One is Chuck C's book, A New Pair of Glasses. What a wonderful treatise on the third step. And another one, Conversations with God, Part 1, is a wonderful statement of detachment in there, where the guy asks God, he says, why didn't Christ heal the people he came across? And he said, how Christ respected their wanting to have the experience they wanted. He gave them the dignity of their own experience unless they truly wanted to change that experience. I said, if a thing like Christ could do that, who am I to want to get in your life and try to change your experience? I respect your experience for what it is, allowing my experience to be mine, because I have choices. I don't have to be around your experience if I don't choose to be. And I can be apart from you and still be partners with you. I don't have to take you over, and don't let you take me over. And that's the gift of this program. I'm going to shut up with this little Dennis Miller thing that he said. And he talked about alcoholics. I'm going to put in the Al-Anon framework. If you don't think you belong in Al-Anon, just go out with the alcoholic in your life who's still drinking and go shop for bathroom tile. If you have this desire to take this tile and put it against their face to see if they're comfortable, you know you belong in Al-Anon. Thanks.